welcome. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's Friday when we invite you into a conversation with journalists about their work and how the top stories of the week were covered. Today in Egypt, tens of thousands of people came into Cairo's Tahrir Square to protest the approval of a draft constitution. That approval followed quickly after President Mohamed Morsi's declaration of expanded powers beyond the review of the country's judiciary, and also after liberal and Christian representatives in the Constitutional Assembly had walked out. And to help us understand the rapidly developing situation in Egypt and the way the news media is responding to it, we are joined by Adil Iskandar. He is co-editor of the electronic magazine Jadalia, and he's columnist with Egypt Independent. He lectures on media and the Arab world at Georgetown University, and he joins us from Washington. Hi, Adil. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Adil, we'll also want to get your response to the coverage of yesterday's UN vote to elevate Palestine to UN observer state status as well.
Well, I think one of the problems with the coverage, at least as far as the United States is concerned, is that there's been sort of a steady demonization of Palestinian politics for quite some time. You'll recall that the coverage of the previous attempt to get full member state status in the U.S. media was extremely negative. It was perceived as an attempt to escape from negotiations or to bypass negotiations or circumvent the parties in the negotiations. In Israel and America's brokerage. And, of course, the attempt failed because in the Security Council of the United States has a veto. And, of course, it's really no different from a lot of the coverage on Palestinian politics and the Palestinian-Israeli conflict at large.
I definitely want to come back to that. And I think it's interesting, actually, looking this morning, even at the headlines in the Israeli media, contrasting those to those in the U.S. media, looking at the difference in the way they're interpreting the vote yesterday. But I want to move on to a couple of things first, and we will definitely come back to talk about Palestine, the U.N., Israel, and its coverage in the media, so for sure. But I also want to talk to one of our other guests, who's Mike Elk, who reports on labor and politics and corporations for In These Times. Earlier this week, details emerged about conditions at a garment factory in Bangladesh, where 112 workers were killed in a fire on Saturday, and where clothes were being produced for global brands, including Disney, Sears, The Gap, and the world's largest retailer, Walmart. And on the day that fire took place, Walmart officials were actually trumpeting record Black Friday sales and downplaying the effects of coordinated demonstrations across the country by Walmart workers. So we want to talk about how big those strikes were by Black Friday, by Walmart workers, and whether this is the bellwether of a larger wave of organizing in parts of the economy where workers have long been unorganized. Mike Elk is a staff writer for In These Times, who reports on labor, corporations, and politics. Mike, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Great to have you. And also later in the hour, we're going to be joined by Jake Blumgardt. He is an independent reporter who's been following up on another labor business story that kind of became a meme last week, and that was this death of the Twinkie story about the bankruptcy of the Hostess Corporation, which Jake says was not so much about union resistance as it was about vulture capitalism. So we'll unpack that story with him when he joins us in the second half hour of the show. Between now and then, we would love to hear from you as well. Join the conversation. If you have kudos and critiques of this week's journalism, please give us a call. Be specific. What did you see that impressed you or that could have been done better? The number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Did you read, hear, or watch a report this week that really impressed you? We'd love to hear about specific examples of good reporting. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or comment at our website, yourcallradio.org, which is where we'll be posting links to all the stories that we talk about during this hour. So as I say, we're going to jump into the critique of the coverage of these big stories of this week, but we always try to start by talking about an example of well-done journalism for the week. And so I want to start with you, Adil. Do you have an example of some reporting or analysis from this week that you thought was really impressive that you want to direct people to?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the most polarizing discussions right now as far as the Egyptian political scene is concerned applies to is whether or not President Morsi, the current president, is sort of a Democrat or a dictator. And a lot of things have happened in the last few days that entrenched the view either one way or another, which is also true, which has meant that the international media has picked up one strand or another. And I rarely commend The Economist for a good work of journalism, but on the case of Morsi's recent decree, they were able to strike a very, very good balance as far as showing the opposition's stance as well as the president's case. So they weren't pulled in any one direction or another. So I found that to be quite startling and a very sort of sharp piece of reporting on Egypt, which is a rarity from The Economist. And it wasn't very much entrenched in sort of the political economic ideology of the publication.
Well, that's actually was kind of interesting. The Economist, they definitely have a specific ideological viewpoint, but there's some of the reporting that kind of can go independent from that. So how would you say in what they dug into about the situation in Egypt right now, what were some of the details they brought forward that you thought were really important for people to know?
Well, I think to a large extent what they did was be able to show the prospect of both positions. I mean, the majority of the American media's coverage is now extremely glowing of Morsi. Of course, he was able to help the Israelis and the Americans secure a ceasefire with Hamas, something that he's, of course, heralded as having done, and he's nominated for Person of the Year in Time magazine, and he has a full spread, I think, a front-page story in Time magazine, a prominent interview. So he's getting a lot of really wonderful, flowery, glowing press, and I think The Economist were able to showcase that not only is there a significant opposition pouring into the streets today, as they have for the last few days, but also explain what the prospects for both are. I mean, the standoff is one that doesn't really have a clear resolution. He has absolute power, and the protesters have no way of challenging him. And by and large, economists explain that this may translate into a fairly extended standoff that could destabilize the country and lead to the potentiality of the military interfering again, which is, I think, a really sort of clean and sharp way of identifying all the different criteria, all the major players, without necessarily being biased in one direction or another. And I think the reason why The Economist did a good job here is because, perhaps from their own sort of bias, trying to identify where the foreign investors' interests might be, it's an unreadable scene, which meant that for once they had to basically, find an equilibrium, and they did in the story of Morsi.
Fascinating. And who would have thought 2 years ago that the American press would be friendly to a leader connected with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's totally shocking. In fact, it's such a tidal shift. It's probably dizzying for the average viewer and average reader of the American press. How could Morsi go from sort of heretic to hero in a very, very short time period, almost to the extent that he's being defended outright against or at least to the chagrin of many Egyptians who believe that he's consolidated power in a very dangerous way and in some ways reconstituted the old regime. But he's given the American administration the kind of assurances that they need, that he's not going to go rogue on Israel, that he's protected, American interests in the region. And maybe he's ready to assume the role that Mubarak had previously, to the frustration of many people in the country. But again, I think the American viewership, American audiences, are probably a little bit perplexed. When did the Muslim Brotherhood become a potential ally?
Well, Adel Eskander, thanks for those kudos for The Economist coverage of the situation in Egypt. We're going to be unpacking that story further, but I want to turn to Mike Elk at In These Times to hear from you, Mike. What's a story or a piece of analysis from this week that you thought people should look to? It was well done. Mike, are you with us there? Perhaps not. Let's come back to you. We'll go back to Mike Elk from In These Times in just a moment. So, Adel, just to follow up on what you were talking about, I specifically wanted to go to your point about the military in Egypt, which seems to me like often in the Western press and certainly in the United States, there's the kind of secularist and Islamist divide that I think is comprehensible to people. But the power of the military behind the scenes, and especially when you've got a draft constitution that's largely based on the previous constitution, where the military obviously had a great deal of power under Mubarak, what role do they play, and what do we need to be understanding that we might not from the coverage we're seeing?
Well, that's a great question. I think the military is sort of forgotten in the story. I mean, after Morsi deposed the top two generals in the military, Field Marshal Tantawi and his assistant, or his immediate chief of staff, Sami Anan, there was the supposition that the military has effectively disappeared into the background. But in fact, it's quite the contrary. The military looms large in this constitution. They seem to have cut a deal with the Muslim Brotherhood legislators, who were the ones who drafted the constitution. In fact, the majority of the non-Islamist front effectively boycotted the Constitutional Assembly, so they had full reign, and the military were present. They were front and center. In fact, they had a prominent representative in the Assembly, and they negotiated all the terms and conditions that allow the military to preserve its control of its own assets, that it has. There's no oversight whatsoever, and their budget remains inaccessible to the public and is only viewed by a National Security Council that is comprised of primarily the top branches of the military, as well, or the representatives of the top branches of the military, and the ruling government. So this is a continuation of the old process, the old regime. The greatest problem with the military under the Mubarak era was that it was a Pandora's box. It was inaccessible. Nobody knew what was inside it. And that lasted for at least 60 years from the time of Nasser onward. And it looks like we're going back to that, but with a democratically elected presidency. So this is, it looks like most of the goals of the revolution have not really been accomplished or have not come to fruition in a manner that would satisfy, the protesters and what have you. So this is going to become a hinge issue, but it also helps secure the Muslim Brotherhood in the event that there is significant opposition. The military, you know, they're now working hand in hand, so the possibility of a coup is far less likely given the circumstances, unless there is significant uproar in the country.
That's Adel Iskander. He's co-editor of the online magazine Jadaliyah and columnist with the Egypt Independent. And we welcome you to join our conversation on today's Your Call Media Roundtable. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. The number to call is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you have been following developments in Egypt or more broadly in the Middle East, certainly the aftermath of the bombardment of Gaza and the rocketing of cities targeting of cities in Israel. That's certainly a lot of developments continuing there. The elevation of Palestine to UN observer status that happened yesterday. In observer state status, certainly interesting developments. If you have questions, if you'd like to talk about examples of coverage that you thought were done well or that could have been done better, the number to call, 866-798-8255. And we're also going to be talking about labor and corporate struggles from Walmart to Hostess later in the hour. So if you've been following those developments and have questions, comments, or specific articles that you'd like to direct folks to, please join the conversation. You can also leave comments at yourcallradio.org. I just wanted to ask also, where can people who are not, you know, if you're someone who's, you're like, okay, Egypt, this is an incredibly important country. Clearly, a lot of things are going on, but it is hard to sometimes get inside the internal politics of a country. And I think about, for instance, you know, reading that the liberal and Christian representatives on the Constitutional Assembly walked out earlier this week. And I just, you know, I just kind of want that kind of political perspective, like, did they make the right strategic decision? Are there people who you look to for that kind of analysis or places you would direct people in our audience?
That's a wonderful question. I think to a large extent, there has been a positive that grew out of the Egyptian Revolution, and that's basically international curiosity. People want to know more about Egypt. It's a very strategic country. And so a lot of the media inside Egypt has now become adept at transferring their information or transferring development internationally. So a lot of people follow prominent journalists and reporters who are based in Egypt, Egyptians who are based in Egypt. But in addition to that, there are also English-language newspapers that are increasingly more accessible and more up-to-date.
Give us a couple of names so folks can know where to go.
Absolutely. For instance, there is the state media, there's an independent English-language state newspaper that has improved drastically since the revolution, and it's called Al Ahram. In addition to that, there's also Egypt Independent. It's probably the first major independent.
And you're a columnist there.
Egypt. Yeah, I write for them, so I'm a little bit biased. But in general, I think there's a lot of content that's coming out in English. In addition to that, I would also encourage people to look at slightly more extended and feature length analyses and examinations that might be a little bit scholarly, but can help them glean things in a way that's slightly more sophisticated than the average news reader. And I would also recommend Jabalia for that, another publication that I'm working closely with. So there's an array of information. The key is to diversify your options as much as possible so as to get information from multiple sources and compare them and contrast them and see what sticks, or, you know, what seems most logical. But right now, there's a significant polarization in the Egyptian political scene. It seems as though El Baradei and other sort of members of this revolutionary movement, they've called themselves the Salvation Front, an attempt to save Egypt from the constitution, what have you, that they're going to continue to protest, and they're going to remain in Tahrir Square for an extended period of time. And, of course, the president and the constituent assembly and you know, everyone else is somewhat intransigent within the state authority. So it's a complicated moment, and the best way to do this, if you're an inquisitive reader, is to just diversify your options.
Well, we've got a lot of inquisitive listeners, and we will definitely be posting links to all of those sites at our website, yourcallradio.org, and you can also find Adel Iskander's writings about Egypt linked there, yourcallradio.org, where you can also comment, or you can also call in at 866-798-8255. We now have Mike Elk back on the line, labor reporter for In These Times. Mike, thanks for being with us. We heard from Adel about some reporting that he was impressed with this week. Do you have an example of a report that you really were impressed by?
Well, I have to be honest here, and I don't mean to toot my own horn. I was working on a pretty big story this week, and I wasn't able to do as much reading as I wanted.
I understand.
But we just came out a couple minutes ago with a big story on how federal government and local governments are repeating the mistakes of 9/11 and not adequately training people that are first responders to Sandy cleanup. And there's a lot of workers being exposed to sewage and asbestos and other things that could cause long-term cancer that aren't really being dealt with in an adequate manner. You know, OSHA is giving out respirators that don't even protect against asbestos exposure. Workers aren't being trained. And not only that, OSHA now, on top of that, has relaxed the rules, so they're not citing companies at first for breaking the law. They're giving a chance to work with them, and this is a pretty bad policy. So we just came out with that story, and it's definitely an undercover story. Another really great story was a story Dave Jamieson did at the Huffington Post. He did a story about a sugar lockout at a sugar processing plant that's in the Red River Valley up in North Dakota, Minnesota, Iowa. And about how after 16 months of workers being locked out, going through their unemployment, and going through multiple stages of personal bankruptcies, breakups, all kind of stuff, workers are finally getting around to accepting concessions, and they're going to take pretty big concessions from a company that's profitable.
And And is it simply telling that story that you found impressive, or the way that Dave Jamieson dug into it?
I think the personal level. I mean, Dave's a good writer, and I think the way that he sort of brought out the story, because, you know, often I think as a labor reporter, we say, well, why do folks accept bad deals? And, you know, I think, you know, the reason so many bad deals are accepted is how desperate people get. And I thought it was a good story because you know, it's not a story that's told.
And one of the big stories that came out of this past weekend revolved around Walmart and the protests around Black Friday, which I know that you have reported on and certainly been paying attention to. And that's kind of something going the other direction, right, as opposed to the, you know, unionized workers or organized workers having their expectations ratcheted down. Here are some workers in a sector that's traditionally not been very organized, or certainly in a company that has not been organized, trying to push things the other direction. How important do you think those protests were, and how do you measure that as a reporter? And then what do you think of the coverage that's been out there kind of in the big media?
Yeah, first off, I should say that I haven't covered Walmart at all, but I'm familiar with it.
Okay.
So the story with Walmart is interesting because this is pretty a novel approach, which is what they're doing is they're taking non-union workers out on strike. And, you know, they're typically you would think, oh, well, if you don't have a union and you go out on strike, how are you going to get your job back? But they've been doing this thing called an unfair labor practice strike. And what they're charging, and it's pretty novel, is that since Walmart is engaged in an illegal retaliation, that the union is striking, and that as a result of this illegal retaliation, that despite not being in a union, they're able to strike at any time because the contract is expired. And it's pretty impressive kind of approach to take.
So explain that a little more. So what makes this possible at this time, and how are they protected?
Well, I mean, they're protected legally. They have a right to get their job back.
And what about the...
So typically you could just fire someone, but if there's legal protection, they can get their job back. So this is sort of what's going on here. And I think the biggest part of why these strikes are important, I think it's starting to have a bit of an effect on Walmart's brand and reputation, but Walmart's been hit for years, and it's not going to bend because of that. I think what's important about it is, one, it's showing workers that they can rise up and be protected, and Walmart can't fire them because, you know, you have a couple hundred workers going out on strike, and then more workers will see them joining and likely join in. And two, you know, it's helping quell the illegal retaliation that Walmart typically does, the firings, the threats they typically do during union drives that wind up killing them. So I think it's important in that sense.
So it's more about the message that it's sending to other workers than necessarily about the specific impact they have on Walmart. Mike Elk, within these times... Okay, great. So if you hold on for a moment, because we've got Adil Iskander on the line, and we're going to let him go at a break in just a moment. But Adil, I want to get a quick response from you before we go to break. There is a lot going on right now in the Arab world. You know, hearing about protests in Jordan, that's certainly something very unusual. Concerns about, you know, real civil strife breaking out in Egypt. Where are we in the narrative of the kind of Arab Spring at this point? How would you describe it?
I think there was a little bit of a preemptive excitement about these revolutionary movements. There was the assumption that they're going to come to pass and they're going to bear fruit very quickly. I'm not of the thought that we need to characterize them just yet. That we don't necessarily have to describe them as uprisings or revolutions or protests or civil wars. They're very, very complicated, and they're very dynamic, and they're living creatures. They're organic moments in history, and they're unfolding as we speak. And so we can't really speak to them as in their totality. Bahrain is not Egypt. Egypt is not Tunisia. Tunisia is not Libya. The plight of the human condition and their desire for dignity and social justice and freedom is universal and is something that all of these movements have as a foundational core. But at the end of the day, as things unfold, the particularities of each of those countries materialize in such a way that they become extremely different. So I think we should perhaps stop referring to the Arab Spring as an Arab Spring, not because it's not a spring and it's a winter, but rather because it is not a singular experience for all of the peoples in the region.
Adil Iskander is co-editor of the online magazine Jadalia, columnist with Egypt Independent, and he lectures on media and the Arab world at Georgetown. Adil, thanks so much for joining us today on the Your Call Media Roundtable.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. Also with us is Mike Elk of In These Times, who reports on labor corporations and politics there. And in the second half hour, we're going to be joined by Jake Blumgart, an independent reporter who has been covering the bankruptcy at Hostess. Please stay tuned after this.
All of the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org. They're also included in Your Call's weekly email newsletter. It's easy to get the newsletter, and it's free. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org, and you can highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or send us an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is the Your Call Media Roundtable. We podcast our program. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our e-newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Speaking of which, on Monday, we're going to be revisiting a conversation Rose Aguilar had with David Talbot about the impact of the renewed tech boom on San Francisco and Northern California. And then on Wednesday, we're going to be talking about drones. Is there a right way to use drones internationally, and is what's happening right now under the Obama administration working, and is it legal? That will be coming up this next week on the on Your Call. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org or call us at 866-798-8255, which where we are right now. And this is the Media Roundtable. With us on the line is Mike Elk. He covers labor, politics, and corporations for In These Times. And also joining us is Jake Blumgart, who is an independent reporter who has been covering what the popular press has called the death of the Twinkie story, following up on that, unpacking the specifics of it. Jake, thanks so much for being with us.
Sure thing.
And Jake, we always ask the journalists who join us on the Friday Media Roundtable to talk about a good piece of reporting from the week, since we can get into media criticism most of the time. And I wanted to ask you if there's a particular piece of analysis or reporting this week that you were impressed with.
Yeah, I really liked Sarah Jaffe's piece in The Atlantic called McJob Should Pay Too. And it's about the fast food worker strike in New York this past week. And she really goes into all the details of basically why the fast food industry has been so hard to organize in the past and why it's so important that these strikes are going on, and basically, you know, why the service sector, which is such a huge part of our economy these days, and is just paying, you know, such a huge number of our workforce these poverty wages, and how that's kind of dragging everything down. I would highly recommend that. It's on The Atlantic.
That's Sarah Jaffe in The Atlantic. Maybe talk about, for people who aren't familiar with these job actions that have taken place this week, primarily, right? What's going on at McDonald's and these other fast food restaurants?
Well, there, let's see, hundreds of workers in New York walked out of their jobs yesterday, and this is a whole range of kind of, you know, McDonald's, Burger King, KFC, you know, that kind of restaurant, I guess. And they were pretty much all paid the minimum wage or just like a tiny amount more than that. And they're all demanding higher wages so that they can actually, you know, take care of their kids and, you know, afford transit to work and, you know, just cover all the basic life expenses that they need that are particularly important in a city like New York where the cost of living is so ridiculously high. You know, you just can't really get by on a minimum wage job like that that also doesn't give you, you know, the full hours that you need. So they're demanding more regularized hours, but specifically a higher wage. They're currently demanding wages that are about two times higher than what they currently receive, which is, again, about the national minimum wage of $7.25.
Jake Blumgart, we were talking also with us is Mike Elk from In These Times, and we were talking before you came on about the strikes at Walmart on Black Friday and what kind of impact they were having. And Mike, you were kind of making the argument that the primary impact is the message it sends to workers in other companies, and perhaps the McDonald's workers and other fast food workers in New York would be among them. But I guess to both of you, I'd wonder obviously, you get these big name brands, whether it's McDonald's or Walmart or the Twinkie is a perfect example of it. Suddenly, people pay attention to labor and workers and their issues in a way that they don't when there's, you know, companies that aren't you know, household names. But I think there is a real question of kind of measuring, well, just because there's a protest against Walmart or a protest against a McDonald's restaurant, how powerful those protests are and how much change they can really make. And I'm curious, just as folks who cover labor on a regular basis, how you think about measuring the impact of these actions. Mike, start with you.
Well, no, I think this is a real important point that you brought up. I was talking earlier about the Crystal Sugar lockout story. Certainly that got no attention because it's in North Dakota, it's far away, and I think one of the big challenges of reporting on labor is that it's really isolated struggles at companies that seem far removed from the lives of most people. I mean, most people don't think about turbochargers, but certainly workers that make turbochargers play an important part in our economy. And I think this is a real big issue, and I think it's a real problem that people go after. And, you know, I think Walmart, you know, it's certainly opening stuff up. You know, the reporting on it so far has been interesting, but, you know, I think there could be a lot more done. I mean, I've tried to do a little bit of looking into it, but I've been involved with other stuff. And, you know, I think it would be interesting, you know, what kind of anti-union consultants is Walmart using? Are they filing forms with the Department of Labor accurately listing those consultants? Are they doing all these things that legally they're supposed to be doing? So I think there's a lot of questions there, deeper questions that get at the company. I certainly think the story is dynamic, and a lot of people have certainly picked it up. But I wonder about those kind of questions being answered. And I think it's a question of just sort of the fact that there's not that kind of capacity really for investigative reporting in the media right now.
Jake Blumgart?
Yeah, I'd say one other important thing to mention is that it's not just the Mike was saying there's this in that particular story that he was talking about that there's geographic distance, but I think there's also a lot of these workers, particularly in these low income areas of the economy, are just their stories often aren't explored in a way that white collar jobs are in the national media, and I think you're right also that the fact that these particular strikes have been these large brands have really helped, but there's often there's been a lot of actions and a lot of places against, smaller scale employers, restaurants, things like that, that, you just don't hear about them at all. And I also would agree also with Mike that, the New York Times has a labor reporter. Other than that, it's pretty much all in, the kind of like left wing media sphere, which is great. But, in the mainstream media, there's simply not that much in-depth coverage of worker-related issues.
Go ahead, Mike.
I would actually say that I think the left media on reporting is really bad from a reporting standpoint. I mean, it's mainly cheerleading. People see themselves as allies. You don't see a lot of critical writing about union leaders. You don't see a lot of investigative stuff. And I think a good example, we were going to talk about this, was Hostess reporting. I thought the reporting on the left about Hostess was awful. I mean, they tried to paint, sort of fill your readers in on what happened with Hostess, is that basically Hostess went into bankruptcy, and they were demanding big, big cuts from workers. Basically, over a three-year period, it would have meant that their wages went in half. And they were demanding big, big cuts. And if you read most progressive reporting on it, people would say, oh, well, the reason Hostess went bankrupt is they had this Bain Capital style private equity firm that came in and took over the company and ripped it of its assets and made big profits. But that's not what happened in this case. But that's what, you read John Nichols in The Nation, he's calling it vulture capitalism. The private equity firm, Ripplewood, that was running it was simply incompetent. They lost $130 million on the deal. I mean, they didn't even do dividends. Payouts to their stockholders. They lost money. But, nobody on the left understands business reporting, understands how businesses operate. All you get typically on the left are these stories that are taken almost directly off of press releases from unions that are just not very good reporting, in my opinion. It's unquestioned. People don't understand it. I mean, all you really get out of left labor reporting are sort of the human interest. Oh, this is such a tragedy. I want to kick a company in the knees. If you want to kick a company in the knees as a reporter, you got to go up to their finances. You got to understand what they're about. You got to understand labor law. And there's a huge lack of that on the left. There's a huge lack of imagination. And don't even get me into the sheer incompetency of union leaders that never goes covered because so many left publications get money from unions. So I actually think the left does an awful job of covering media.
Well, Mike,
covering labor.
Mike, we got a full disclosure here, which is Jake Blumgart's piece that ran in Salon. And Jake, I don't know if you chose the headline, but it was "Vulture Capitalism, Not Unions Killed Twinkies." So, Jake, this is part of the angle that you took. What Mike is criticizing here, what do you think its validity is?
Sure. Okay. So, I mean, as usually happens with articles, or at least in my experience, I did not choose the title, and I would say. I do agree, you know, for instance, that the vulture capitalism angle isn't really the right one. It's more that the management completely mishandled everything and that Ripplewood came in and, you know, seemed like it was going to, or promised that it was going to, you know, that had this great plan to revitalize the company. And then they didn't have that. And so I think a big problem here was that, you know, the unions had no say in, you know, the choice of how the company was being run. They basically just sat there on their hands. They had no, no voice on the board or anything like that. I interviewed Eileen Applebaum for my article, and she really went into a lot of detail about.
And who is she?
She's a economist with the Center for.
That's all right. Go ahead. Just talk about what she had to tell us.
Sure. Let's see. So. And her point basically was that neither the hedge funds nor the unions had a voice in how the company was run after it was brought out of its initial bankruptcy. And again, you know, management just kind of ran it into the ground and did not, you know, attempt to revitalize the company in any significant way. And so this kind of outcome was basically almost unavoidable. And, you know, I think this is going to be, and in this case, management, you know, I feel like didn't have huge incentives to save the company because they're kind of trying to get, you know, they're, you know, paid out. The hedge funds can sell the company for scraps, and the union really, you know, had the most incentive to try to save the company. But, you know, the way that, American unions generally don't have much of a say at the management level due to a number of historical factors. And I think the latest prior to the bankruptcy, you know, the along with another round of concessions, the company, I believe there are some seats on the board available or that the company was offering to the unions, but, you know, it was a little, too late kind of thing.
That's Jake Blumgart. He's an independent reporter who's reporting on labor and other parts of the economy. Can be found on Salon and other on other publications. Also with us is Mike Elk, who covers labor, politics, and the economy for In These Times. We welcome you to join the conversation at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. We're really digging into coverage of clashes between workers and corporations, sometimes workers organized in labor unions, as in the case of the Hostess bankruptcy, other times outside the union organizing realm, and that is in Walmart, McDonald's, other fast food restaurants. Do you think you get the kind of in-depth reporting that you want? And do you agree with Mike Elk that we're really not getting, whether there's kind of the corporate media or the left media that's on the other side of things, that we don't get the kind of in-depth, really critical reporting that we need? The number to call is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. And if you've been following either the Twinkies, the death of the Twinkies story, or what came out of the Walmart strikes, or the fire in Bangladesh at the garment factory where 112 workers were killed, at a place where Walmart, The Gap, Disney, all these major brands were having their garments made in a situation which was clearly, anyone could see, was dangerous for those workers, doors locked and the rest. If you have questions, if you have comments on the coverage, please give us a call, join the conversation. Mike Elk, I wanted to come back to you. When you're hearing the analysis from Jake Blumgart, anything you'd like to add or where you say coverage of a story like this should go next?
Well, I think Jake's, you know, I read Jake's article and it was fairly accurate in terms of what happened there. But, you know, again, in order to sell the story, you know, you saw whoever the editor was at Salon decided to hype up the headline. That's not reporting. You know, and it's not Jake's fault, you know, it's whoever edited it. That's not reporting. I mean, reporting is just telling the story. But, you know, it's one of those things where I just think there's not enough focus on doing the boring reporting. The boring reporting you do day in, day out, that maybe... You know, I've covered stories for 2.5 years that I've reported numerous small, little, boring stories on, and then eventually they add up. And I think that's a real problem we face as a media. You know, I think this is a big problem. And, you know, I think the labor movement plays responsibility. There is not enough investigative reporting out there. Organized labor spent, what, $500 million in the last election. ProPublica, the online site, does a lot of great investigative reporting that's in the New York Times and other places, has a great investigative reporting lab. They've won Pulitzers. They spend a budget of about $8 million a year. Now, imagine if organized labor said, we're going to get all kind of laid-off reporters, good business reporters, good labor reporters, get them to dig into companies, get them to dig into stuff, and, you know, we'll give them a budget of $10 million a year, right? That would actually do a lot of good. But the problem is that organized labor doesn't want that. They don't want anything they can't control. So a big part of the reason I think that the left media is, especially on labor issues, going down the drain, which is that anybody on the left, almost everybody on the left, takes money from labor. You know, the American Prospect last year took $400,000 from organized labor, but yet they don't have a single full-time labor reporter. Everybody on the left media takes money from labor, but there's not that kind of critique. It's just very boring. I'm just so shocked that so many of my colleagues on the left haven't been accused of plagiarism for some of these stories they write that look like they come straight off of press releases.
Well, hey, we've got a couple of folks on the line who want to weigh in here. Andy in Redwood City, welcome to your call.
Yes, Matt, thanks. Yeah, this question is for Mr. Elk or Jake in his torturous comments he just had. It was said that labor didn't have a place on the board of Hostess. My understanding is Dick Gephardt's son was on the board of Hostess, and Dick Gephardt had a lot to do with negotiating the deal between the unions and Ripplewood and the management of Hostess. And I was wondering if either of your two journalists could comment on the role of Dick Gephardt with this Hostess debacle that went on. That
yeah,
was certainly a travesty.
Yeah, I can certainly talk about that. I mean, you know, Dick Gephardt's been amazing since he's left Congress. Dick Gephardt, by the way, is the former Democratic minority leader in the House of Representatives. He was considered a good labor guy for a long time. Even fought against his own party, fought against Bill Clinton on NAFTA. Gephardt, since he's left office, has done things like get involved in the Hostess thing and kind of muck it up. But another thing that's interesting to note and has been noted by others is that Dick Gephardt also represents Sodexo as a lobbyist. And when SEIU and other unions have been in fights with Sodexo, Dick Gephardt goes around Capitol Hill and tells congressmen and senators, oh, well, don't pay attention to that. You know, it's not that big of a deal. And he'll shill for Sodexo in their anti-union drive. So, you know, Dick Gephardt, I'm not too aware of his entire role in Hostess, but judging from his Sodexo work, it wouldn't surprise me if he was sticking it to the union.
Fascinating. Jake Blumgart, you find anything about Dick Gephardt in your reporting on the Hostess bankruptcy?
I mean, I basically found, you know, that he had some ties with Ripplewood, and that, but yeah, there's a really great article from The Nation from like 3 years ago October 2009 that about Gephardt's activities as a lobbyist and how, you know, and again, as Mike was saying, he was, you know, known as a fairly progressive guy when he was in Congress and an ally of labor and all this kind of stuff. And so I highly recommend reading this article called Jake Gephardt's Spectacular Sellout, again, in The Nation from about 3 years ago. So I can't really speak to the exact details of his involvement in the Hostess scandal, but yeah, he definitely has kind of tarnished his record a bit since leaving Congress.
We will post that on our website, yourcallradio.org, where you can also leave comments or questions. You just hearing from Jake Blumgardt. He's an independent reporter who covers labor and other issues. You can read him in many different outlets. Also with us, Mike Elk from In These Times, Labor Corporations and the Economy reporter there. And we have on the line Chris in Redwood City. Welcome to Your Call.
Hey, guys. So I guess just a couple of comments that that I have that I'd like to hear your guests speak about. And one is there's a general dissatisfaction with Congress because their unwillingness to compromise on anything. And it seems like what gets reported in the media is the same mentality with unions and management. And you know, I'm actually from Chicago, new to the Bay Area, and have been had followed the situation with the Chicago Teachers Union very closely. And same thing with the Hostess situation. I followed it very closely. And the way it plays out in the media is that it's very combative. And so that's sort of comment number one that bleeds into this next comment that I'd like to hear some feedback on, which is this idea that, in my mind, that the media is mostly trying to play to what they think their audience wants, which is entertainment. And, you know, for example, sensationalizing the title of the article by calling it vulture capitalism. You know, as an audience, as a reader, like, I don't want that. I do just want that simple little reporting that your one guest talked about, which may be not as exciting, but it's actual just reporting and not flavored with...
It may be boring, not necessarily simple. That's the thing.
Those are the two points, and I'll take my listening off air.
Great, Chris. Welcome to the Bay Area. Mike Elk, you want to respond?
Yeah, I think this is a great point that Chris brought up. Which is that, you know, part of the reason why Salon slapped that title on it is they get clicks. They get a lot of clicks off of that kind of thing. And, you know, they get a ton of clicks off of that. And their model now is based on getting advertising revenue based off of clicks. So there's an incentive to play to people's audience, to gin things up. And I see journalists do it all the time, and quite frankly, I think it's disgusting.
Jake Blumgardt, anything?
I mean, in my opinion, being a journalist is like being a doctor. You have to give an accurate diagnosis of something. People's lives depend on it. I've always been of the school that I think like journalists should have to take like a Hippocratic oath or have to go to a bar association or something because
first do no
so many people commit malpractice every day.
Well. Mike, just because we are short on time, and you all at In These Times have just posted this report titled "Worker Health Advocates Say 9/11 Mistakes Repeated in Sandy Cleanup." So I want to direct folks to that. We have posted on our website, yourcallradio.org, if they want to read through about that. But tell me, what's the genesis of a story like this? How did you start following these developments to the point where you come up with a big report like this?
The report like this, you know, I've been covering workplace safety issues forever. I know folks give me a call, I talk to them, but I wouldn't know these folks if I didn't cover the boring stories of, you know, ergonomic standards. That's how I get to know them.
And so people reached out to you saying, hey, this is, we haven't learned something in more than a decade from the 9/11 cleanup, which people thought, oh, well, at least we should have learned from that.
Yeah, people reached out, and that's where it went from that.
And do you want to, one of the nuggets that people might want to hear that like, okay, here's something from this story that, boy, that makes you want to go read the rest of it. What would you point to?
Well, OSHA, I think the biggest issue is that they're handing out respirators to cleanup workers, OSHA is, that don't protect workers against asbestos. And many of them are having to deal with asbestos. So I think that's a big concern. I think the second big concern is that OSHA is not enforcing the law. They're allowing companies a grace period. They're giving them several warnings they wouldn't give them ahead of time. And then
slapping fines on them. So I think those are the big issues.
And do you, have you managed to kind of get at what you think the motivations of OSHA is in kind of granting those? Is it, was it about moving things along very quickly?
Yeah, I mean, they say in the story that moving things along quickly, and that they think they, you know, it's easier. You don't have to do all the paperwork. And OSHA is a small agency that if you, you know, you don't find people right away, you don't cite them, that, you know, it eliminates paperwork and you can work with an employer and an employer is more willing to work with you and all this kind of stuff. I mean, that's what they say. But the other side of the coin is, well, you know, do you tell the, do the police, you know, say you're a guy who just went out and sold some drugs. Can you go to the police and tell them, oh, well, you know, I was in a crisis. It was a crisis situation. I had to sell the drugs. That doesn't happen. But a big company can say, well, it's a crisis, so you can't hold me responsible for killing these workers. I mean, OSHA would hold someone responsible for killing a worker, but for following the law. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand totally. Mike Elk, thank you so much for being with us on the Your Call Media Roundtable. Mike Elk is a reporter, staff reporter for In These Times, covering labor, corporations, and politics. You can read his, we've got links to his work, including this piece we're just discussing, at our website, yourcallradio.org. Mike, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
And also with us has been Jake Blumgart. Jake, so much for your thanks so much for your reporting on the Hostess bankruptcy, which folks can read at yourcallradio.org. Hope to have you back again.
Thank you.
I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar on this week's Media Roundtable. Please stay tuned. We'll let you know what's coming up on Monday. How much technology can a city take? On the next Your Call, we'll revisit a conversation with journalist David Talbot about San Francisco's digital gold rush, which he says is causing the city to struggle for its soul. Talbot reports that the new tech boom has added $6 billion to the city's tax rolls over the past year, but rents are soaring and many people are being squeezed out. How do you see the renewed tech boom affecting your community? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Coming up on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, as lawmakers work to stop us from going over the so-called fiscal cliff, some members of the GOP have backed off an anti-tax pledge. Aaron Blake of the Washington Post joins us to talk about it. A Seattle teacher is profiled on our education series, Too Important to Fail, and saxophonist Dave Koz with his first live CD on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI.
The Tavis Smiley Show beginning in 1 hour at 12 noon. Following that at 1, Tavis and Dr. Cornel West. We continue now with our daily presentation of World Have Your Say from the BBC. It's 11 o'clock, and this is KALW San Francisco.
Hello, welcome to World Have Your Say. I'm Nuala McGovern. What does it take to make a country?
We came to affirm the legitimacy of a state that must now achieve its independence, and that is Palestine.
This is a week that has seen the UN vote to recognize Palestine as a non-member observer state. Also in Catalonia, separatists won the majority in an election, pushing for independence from Spain. And Egypt has rushed through a draft constitution, which President Morsi hopes will stop the social unrest. Do these examples offer insight on what it takes to be a country? Is it recognition by the UN? Is it geography? A common language? A constitution? Well, coming up, we have a number of guests.